It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent. If you were one of the millions of people glued to a television set on July 21st, 1969, you probably felt a chill run down your spine when you heard these words.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Neil Armstrong electrified the entire world with just two sentences. NASA had achieved its goal of putting men on the moon. Do you remember listening to or watching the live broadcasts of the Apollo missions? What was that experience like? And what would it be like for us to return to the moon? Is that something we should do? Is it the best use of our resources? Or should we explore something else? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@WPR.org or tweet us at WPR Mornings. Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC News Television and the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, John, and thank you for the opportunity to join you and your listeners.
Well, set the scene for us. What was the country like as we prepared to send astronauts to the moon in the 60s to fulfill that famous promise that President Kennedy made?
Well, you really had, I believe, two cultures. You had the 60s revolution, cultural, you know, feminism, the sexual revolution, protests on campus, and that was largely a coastal, bi-coastal phenomenon. If you went into the heartland, it was a much different story, and it was certainly a much different story at NASA, where you had very young engineers. The average age of the people in mission control was 26. That's hard to believe at this point, but that was in fact the case, and they just had their nose to the rail there, and they had one goal, and that was to get to the moon in Kennedy's time frame. You know, by 1968, of course, we had gotten the first Apollo mission to the moon. That was Frank Borman, Jim Lovell, and Bill Anders, and there was the famous Christmas Eve broadcast. So really, there were just two different sides to what was happening in America at that point.
So what were the goals of those early Apollo missions?
Well, they first started, of course, with Mercury and Gemini, and those were the building blocks to Apollo. The key to all of it was orbital rendezvous and docking the command module with another vehicle. In this case, ultimately, it was going to be the lunar lander. So that was really the goal of Mercury and Gemini, and to see how well the astronauts could adapt to space. We just didn't know at that point, which is why we put chimps up in the beginning to see what the effects of zero G would be, and whether or not they could operate outside the space capsule. And of course, that told them whether they could, you know, ultimately be able to walk on the moon and survive the atmosphere there.
You refer to the astronauts who landed on the moon as eagles. Why is that?
In my interviews with them, the thing that struck me, John, was their eyes. You can tell a lot about a person by their eyes. And these men are now approaching their 90s, and they still have that alert look, and they are still active and in incredible shape. Borman, who's 90, still flies his vintage planes. Anders, who's 86, same thing. And the eagle was the majestic symbol that they put on, certainly on the Apollo 11 mission patch. And it just struck me that they were, in fact, like eagles, alert, majestic, and they still have that presence, even at this age.
What were the basic qualities that all of these astronauts seemed to share? What where did they come from?
They were mostly from rural backgrounds. There were a couple from privileged backgrounds, like Pete Conrad, who was a Princeton grad, and interestingly, Al Shepard, who is a Mayflower descendant. But by and large, they were kids from farms, struggling, and they succeeded, you know, on their wits and determination, and those really are the major background characteristics. The psychological profiles, of course, showed that they had tremendous self-confidence. Most of them were firstborns. Only 10% of those who were selected came from broken families. So there was a lot of stability there. And the thing that separated them from everyone else was their assessment of calculated risk. We've all, well, not all of us, but many have seen the movie The Right Stuff, which they did not like, and they thought that the book was far more accurate. But they had a very finely tuned appreciation for calculated risk. They were not reckless. They were not fearless. They knew fear. They knew how to conquer it and manage it. And one of the things I discuss in the book is how to conquer one's fear.
Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. What do you want to see when it comes to the future of space exploration? Are you excited by private sector efforts, or are you worried about them? Let us know what you think at 800-642-1234. Basil, in 1968, human perspective about Earth changed with that first Apollo crew leaving Earth's orbit and that iconic photo of the Earth seen from the moon. What was that experience like for us, seeing the Earth, the moon, and how did that change our perspective about Earth?
Well, the irony for the Apollo astronauts, John, was that they went to explore the moon. In fact, what happened was they discovered the Earth. What really caught their attention as they were orbiting the moon was not the moon itself. I mean, obviously they were curious, but as soon as they made their fourth orbit on Apollo 8, up comes the Earth, and it just left them in awe. And you can hear from the transcripts, the wows and the oh my gods. So the Earth itself is what struck them. And from 240,000 miles out, their overriding impression was small and fragile. And then when they returned, 201, the identical conclusion was that we are living in the Garden of Eden on Earth, and we have just failed to realize it.
What about the rest of the world? How did seeing those photographs of our Earth from that distance, how did that change us as humanity?
Well, it helped launch the environmental movement. We had never seen Earth from deep space, and it was quite clear in the 60s and before, starting really in the 19th century, when industrial pollution began. And so there was a recognition that the Earth was precious, but it didn't really hit home until we saw those photos. The other seed that it implanted, John, was this notion that we are one human race, a planetary species, and not, you know, individual ethnic groups. They stopped seeing the Earth in terms of countries, borders, races. It really was an epiphany that struck them all.
And that's kind of ironic, considering the rise of populism and nationalism these days. We seem to really have lost that thing that we learned in 1968 about being an Earth and being the human inhabitants of that Earth. Did that strike you at all?
It did strike me, and there was a fascinating observation by Mike Collins, who was on, you know, Apollo 11 with Aldrin and Armstrong. And when they went on their round the world tour, when they came back, what struck Collins was that everywhere they went, didn't matter, Asia, Africa, Europe, everyone said to them, not you Americans did it, it was we did it. We, humanity, we did it. And it just stunned them to hear the we as opposed to you. And it was just a brief moment in the history, frankly, of the human race, where we all collectively saw the moon landing as a planetary accomplishment.
Did these people, these men who went to the moon, did they think of themselves as heroes?
They did not. And to this day, they do not. And one of the things that they abhor is this notion of inflated heroism and celebrity culture. They just cannot tolerate it. The only one who really is the outlier in all of this is Buzz Aldrin, who has desperately sought attention from the day he landed and came back. But they believe in the common good and in something greater than oneself. You don't hear much about the common good anymore or believing in something greater than oneself, but they cite this as one of the sources of their courage. And I wanted to do a deep dive into this and really do the right stuff 2.0. And when I initially contacted them, they wanted to know, well, what is it that you're doing that hasn't already been done? And when I said that I wanted to touch on the existential questions, that got their attention.
And we will talk about that as our conversation with Basil Hero continues. He's the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. What do you want to see when it comes to the future of space exploration? There's time for you to get in on the conversation at 800-642-1234. John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent on The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.
And from the crew of Apollo 8, we close with good night, good luck, a Merry Christmas, and God bless all of you on the good earth.
Those words in 1968 from the crew of Apollo 8 changed the way, along with a big photograph of the Earth from over 240,000 miles away, changed the way we think about our world. But what is our hope for the future of space exploration? That's what we'd like you to think about this morning. Would you like to see a return to the moon like we had with the Apollo missions? Or is there some better use of our resources to explore space? 800-642-1234, ideas@WPR.org. You can also tweet us at WPR Mornings. Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Basil, when astronauts did touch the moon's surface, what was the takeaway? What did they learn or realize about Earth standing on the moon?
It was the fragility and the essentially the smallness of the Earth in the solar system. But again, it did give them a newfound appreciation for Earth as the Garden of Eden. And it interestingly, Jim Lovell, you know, who was made famous by Apollo 13, concluded that we don't go to heaven when we die. We go to heaven when we are born. And I was just struck by that. And I called up the dean of the Yale Divinity School and I said, have you ever heard such a statement before? He says, no, I have not. It's a complete transposition of the ascendancy narrative, and Lovell's experience seeing the Earth from the moon is what created that. One of the moonwalkers found Jesus on the moon. Another came back and was convinced that there was a higher power much in the way of the Force that we read about and hear about in Star Wars. And so they just reframed their view. They said that they went out as engineers and came back as humanitarians.
Once we made it to the moon, though, political and public interest seemed to fade. Why? What was behind that decline in support for missions like Apollo?
Well, we have to remember this was all in the context of the Cold War, beating the Russians to the moon. So really, it was as if we had put ourselves on war footing to get there. And then once we had accomplished it, I think certently the competitive instinct withered. And then it was a question of how do we now reframe our thoughts about space exploration. And it was very expensive. It was $20 billion. And the belief was that to launch the space shuttle, a reusable spacecraft, and then ultimately from that experience, be able to build a spacecraft that would be able to venture out to Mars and elsewhere. So the political and the financial will was simply gone after the moon landing.
And for the men that went to the moon, how did they feel about NASA essentially killing moon missions?
Well, they were distraught, obviously. Their hope was that we would continue returning to the moon and building a lunar base. So here we are 50 years later, and that is precisely what NASA wants to do. And it, clearly we could have done it if we had continued with the missions. And now we're left in the rather extraordinary position of not having a rocket that's powerful as the Saturn V. We're essentially starting from scratch again.
So we no longer really have the capability to escape the Earth's gravity.
That's correct.
Basil Hero is the author of the forthcoming book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon. Each president changes the mission of his predecessor in terms of space policy. Now the Trump administration has decided to return to the moon with a request for help from the private sector. How did the Eagles react to hearing this?
They're for it, because the truth is that in the 60s, there was a marriage of NASA and the private sector. NASA itself had 36,000 employees, but it subcontracted all of the work out to 400,000 people, engineers, and 20,000 contractors. So that relationship had existed, and they're doing the same again, although they seem to be relying a little bit more on Blue Origin and SpaceX and Bezos and Musk. So they are for it. They have more faith in Bezos and Blue Origin, frankly, than they do in Musk and SpaceX, even though they've had more launches. And it comes down to their perception of the men and their fear of anyone who's a showboater. And so they think Bezos is a safer bet long term.
What are the perceived benefits of going back to the moon for research?
There is helium-3 on the moon, which is the most precious resource that exists. It's now valued at $5 billion per metric ton. It would revolutionize nuclear power, and we would go from fission to fusion, which is a far more powerful source of nuclear power. And interestingly, the astronauts believe that we should restart our nuclear power industry, because they think it is cleaner and a much faster way of satisfying our energy needs.
Given these conversations you've had with these men, what should the future of space exploration look like? What is their hope?
Well, the most interesting comment came from Neil Armstrong, who 2 years before he died said that he believed that we had not evolved enough as a species to colonize the rest of the universe. Essentially, he was saying, look, we've screwed up here on Earth. Until we clean up our act here, what is it that we are going to export to other planets? So he was, in my estimation, what I would like to describe as a quiet genius. He was steeped in the classics. This was not necessarily the case for the other moonwalkers, but they believe that we should, in fact, explore the rest of the universe. They believe that the moon should be the staging area to get to Mars. And of course, the technology that would be required to accomplish this would have the same spin-off benefits, they believe, that we saw in the 1960s from the moonshot.
When you consider the lives of these astronauts, what's the final lesson we should take away today?
I think it's a reminder of quiet patriotism, of humility, of believing in the common good and something greater than oneself, and to appreciate the planet and remember that as we now know, it really is the only planet in the universe that has the ingredients for life. We've just not seen it anywhere else, and we need to realize that this is the Garden of Eden, and we need to take care of it. That's their message. That's the lesson.
Thank you, Basil Hero, for joining us today. Really appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Basil Hero is a former investigative reporter with NBC News television stations. He's also the author of the book, The Mission of a Lifetime, Lessons from the Men Who Went to the Moon, which comes out next week. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm John Munson in for Kate Archer Kent.